This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with a fellow from Dyer who has designed what could be best called as one of the most popular games around. On Roblox.com, you can see it there, Vehicle Simulator. We'll talk with Joshua D. about that. Also, we have with us as well Mitch Barloga with MRPC talking about the Greenways Pathways 2020 plan that's in its final stages and the public comment period is wrapping up soon. And from the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office, Michelle Fayman talks with us about the upcoming May 8th primary elections and everything you need to know about the elections ahead. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Joshua D. is known in the world of PC gaming as behind the number 3 top-earning game on Roblox. It's called Vehicle Simulator. It has more than 100 million play sessions to date. It's probably pushing 200 million right now. We don't know. But we're going to talk with Joshua D. He is a real person. His name is Joshua DeBoer, and he's a 20-year-old from Dyer, Indiana. And he's with us to talk about coming up with this great game that in turn has become so popular. And Joshua, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much. I'm glad I had the opportunity to do this with you also.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, about Joshua DeBoer. What got you interested in the games, in the gaming industry, and come up with such an interesting game that has become now so very, very popular?
Pretty much ever since, you know, I was obviously young, I always had a thing for video games. I mean, what young man can honestly say that when they were younger that they didn't have an interest in video games? At one point, it honestly kind of became a little bit of an unhealthy obsession for me, where I was spending easily 10 to 12 hours a day playing video games and such. And what kind of got me going with video games is that at a younger age, I had some learning difficulties, and I had some speech and social difficulties, and the doctors said that I was very autistic, and they told my parents I would never speak a word in my life, basically. But my parents, you know, they work with me and such, and here I am now, 20 years later, life is good. But the one thing I always kind of had trouble with was expressing an idea in words. Like, if I had a thought in my head or I had a vision in my head, I didn't have the artistic capabilities to actually draw that out. You know, I couldn't draw a diagram, or I couldn't paint the mental pictures for others and such. So what kind of got me into video games was the fact that I said, hey, I have this idea right here, and there's these tools right here. It's like an easy-to-use canvas with paintbrushes and paint for me, something I can easily understand because I've been playing video games all my life. And that's kind of what got me going with actually making video games, was the ability for me to express my thoughts and what I was thinking into a physical format that others could easily interpret. Specifically, at least what got me making video games, I was originally going to be an IT guy. So I was going to work as a systems administrator for whatever company. I went to college for 3 years for that. Regrettably, that college I went to, they went bottoms up for some reason. I went to another college. They got sued and discharged all my loans. So I'm like, all right, this is double or nothing right here. I've kind of got a bad luck streak. You know, I basically have 3+ years in college with no degree due to technical difficulties. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go do something fun. I used to run a computer repair business, and I used to fix, you know, business computers and consumer computers and such. But I never really clicked with it.
Well, this is a group called Tech Team 911, right?
Yep. Yeah, I used to own that business. So I would actually come out to clients' places, be it business clients or consumer clients. I'd be there within 24 hours to go ahead and fix the issue.
Right.
And the turnaround time, at least the goal was to have a 24 to 48 hour turnaround time was the goal with that. And, you know, I did that for a long time. And I honestly, it was really enjoyable. And it really taught me valuable business skills and such that I'm actually applying well on the Roblox platform at this point. But what kind of got me into making video games was the fact is, basically, it's like making your own recipe when cooking. You know, you see all these recipes in the cookbook, but you can't find the one that speaks truly to you. And I'm like, I'm looking on Roblox, and I'm like, man, there's no games that are like this. You know, I wanted to make a racing game. You know, I wanted to make something where you could be competitive with friends and such. And eventually I met my business partner one day, his same name is Mikhail, and we kind of hit things off. I worked with his brother previously on a couple small projects and such, and we hit things off, and here we are now. And now, it was just great because we both shared the same vision pretty much, that we both wanted to make a racing game, and we both wanted to make a game that would push the boundaries of what's considered normal in the Roblox industry at this point in terms of technical achievement and gameplay. And it's just really cool that I'm able, you know, we both share the same vision at heart, basically. So that's kind of what got me going into that.
Okay. For listeners who don't know what Roblox is, give us a moment and tell us a little bit about Roblox and how this platform got a chance to give you an opportunity to actually create Vehicle Simulator.
Yeah, absolutely. So Roblox has been around for a long time. I actually just taught a physical course on how to work with Roblox for people who have never used it. But Roblox has been around originally in like the 1990s, if I recall right. It was under another, there was like a prototype of it. The two owners, David Baszucki and Eric Castle, both made a 2D physics engine that was used in school. So the whole point was you could basically say what happens if one block hits another block or a car hits a car. You know, it was used to simulate what physics were like.
Right.
And then back in 2005, Roblox registered this thing. It was called Dynablox, is what it was called. And Dynablox was really open to select few people. Like, you know, it was a closed group that was able to actually test it. In 2006, that's kind of when they officially opened up to the public, and they had only a preset list of games. You couldn't really make your own games back then. You know, it was very limited. There were maybe a couple hundred people playing. But over the years, pretty much, that grew. And now, at least, there's been 11.7 billion hours people have played on Roblox since 2008.
Wow.
There's about 650 plus million hours that people spend on Roblox in a month. At times, especially during the holidays and such, there's been recorded 1.7 million people playing games or interacting with the Roblox site at once. And it's just a really cool platform. A lot of people compare it to Minecraft. And, you know, Minecraft is the game where you basically have the building blocks and it's kind of a survival-type game and you can play with friends. You know, people are like, oh, Roblox ripped off of Minecraft. And I'm like, the easiest way to compare it is you can make Minecraft in Roblox.
Uh-huh.
That's how powerful their engine is, pretty much. And
wow.
That's the tools they give you are easy to learn. There's not a big learning curve with the tool, but if you invest enough time into it, it's a very powerful engine. There's been some crazy things. But basically, Roblox lets you, the creator, make an idea and publish it to the world or just your friends to play for free. So they give you the tools. They give you the studio to basically build your projects. They give you the web hosting. They take care of the website moderation to make sure that it's a safe community online. They take care of adding new features that you can use in studio to increase the quality of your game. They publish to other platforms. They take care of the advertising, everything. The low cost is $0 per month per year.
Now, I understand that Vehicle Simulator is as you say, it's part of Roblox.com now. It gives you a chance to either to drive or to fly or to sail any number of vehicles, I suppose, planes, boats, cars, and all. Do you think that this is an idea that maybe, along with the fact that it's a great opportunity to come up with something interesting for Roblox, and it maybe it gives people who would love to learn how to fly or love to sail a boat that can't, for whatever reason, give them a chance to actually do so.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that there was another user, I believe he's active now, but he retired a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Stefan, and he went by the username of CrazyMan32. He was a veteran programmer in the community since the beginning, basically. And I actually looked up to him for the longest time for inspiration because I was always in awe of looking at his work. He specifically made a lot of stuff related to aeronautics. So he was building rockets, he was building planes, he was making dogfighting games, you name it. And I discovered one day when I asked him, you know, he did an interview and he was like, you know, why do you make all these flight simulator type games? And he said basically that, you know, because of my vision, you know, he had vision difficulties and had to wear glasses, that he'd never be able to join, you know, the Air Force and such, or fly a plane for real.
Right.
And he said Roblox basically was the opportunity for him to experience what it would actually be like. So I never really thought about it with Vehicle Simulator, but I could agree with that, that, you know, it's just, it's cool to be able to drive whatever car you want or fly a plane across the island, or, you know, you can obviously sail a boat. It's pretty cool. I can totally see that.
Now, Joshua, I have to ask you, since this has become so successful, so popular, is there anything else that is in the works that's on the drawing board right now that can maybe go ahead and follow through on Vehicle Simulator?
We do have a lot of plans in store at this point. We're going to be completely redoing the map, because right now it's relatively small. Like, it takes maybe 30 seconds to get from point A to point B with the fastest type of vehicle. So we want to redo the map, and we want to make it a lot larger and a lot more detailed overall, is one thing on the drawing boards. We also want to get over to mobile devices in the near future. So we want to be able to play on Apple devices and Android devices, be it phones and tablets. We want to go ahead and publish the game there. Right now you can play it on PC, Mac, and then the Xbox One, but we don't have it on mobile right now, and that's an untapped market. And people have been asking, like, hey, when is Vehicle Simulator coming out to mobile? And it's like, you know, both Mikhail and I were like, shoot, you know, we better start working on this.
I guess that's the demand. That's your goal, I guess, exactly. Is to be able to follow through to make it more accessible to more people, it sounds, for sure. So it sounds like this certainly is going to be an opportunity to follow through, and I'm sure probably some other great ideas are going to follow through as well. We've been talking to Joshua DeBoer. It goes by Joshua D. He's known in the world of PC gaming because of the number three top earning game in Roblox called Vehicle Simulator. He's really the vice president, and he's the lead programmer for an organization that's called Summa Studio Games. And Joshua is a native of Dyer, Indiana. And Joshua, thanks for talking with us about this great game, your thoughts behind this, and it sounds like that your mom and dad are very proud of you right now.
You know, I wouldn't be where I am without them, because as the doctor said a while back, I literally would not be talking to you right now. I'd basically be a vegetable. So without the support of my friends and family that were really passionate about whatever career choice I was going to make, I definitely wouldn't be here right now. So I'm grateful for them.
Joshua, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much, Chris.
At the State House, Senate committees unanimously recommended the creation of a special legislative study commission to investigate the state's Department of Child Services. Democratic Senator Eddie Melton of Maryville authored the resolution. He says that his proposed two-year commission is not meant to interfere, though, with the ongoing independent review of the embattled state agency.
I think this is a great opportunity for legislators to remain engaged in this process.
And the original resolution had called for listing causes for the recent surge in DCS cases that included poverty, substance abuse, and crime. The Senate committee stripped that language out. Melton supports the change. He says he wants the commission to be as open as possible.
I ensured it didn't leave out any other contributing factors to children. So I think the most important part is to make sure we have the committee established.
That resolution of Melton's now goes before the full Senate. The number of hate groups in Indiana jumped about 15% last year, according to a new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello reports, that's higher than the national average of about increase of about 4%.
In 2017, Indiana ranked 11th in the nation with 30 hate groups. That's up from 13th the year before. Indiana University Maurer School of Law professor Janine Bell says the increase is especially concerning since Indiana is one of five states without a hate crimes law.
I think that's a very good reason to be worried about this. We're seeing an increase in white supremacist organizations that engage in behavior like cross-burning.
Hate crimes legislation has been proposed and failed at the Indiana State House for decades, most recently last month. The Southern Poverty Law Center report notes a decline in Ku Klux Klan groups, but says groups with white supremacist ideology are growing significantly. In Indiana, KKK groups declined, but neo-Nazi groups and anti-Muslim groups increased. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission is working on a plan to improve the region's transportation system by increasing the number of greenways and the blueways by the year 2020. Public's encouraged to check out the draft plan and provide some comments on that plan until Friday at 5 p.m. I had a chance to talk with the chief staffer at NERPC behind the plan, Mitch Barloga. Mitch, is very important, I guess, for people to understand that what you're looking at here is a plan that is going to address three major areas of our life in Northwest Indiana: conservation, recreation, and transportation. And that's, it may be easy to say, but it's not necessarily easy to do, I imagine.
No, not at all, Chris. In fact, from my understanding and looking at other regions and how they tackle these matters, we haven't seen a real integration of these three planning ideals. Mm-hmm. I mean, in our region, we have had a lot of great focus on our environmental, our ecology, and the gems that we have along the dunes and so forth. And, of course, our non-motorized transportation network, the way the trails have burgeoned over the years. And we're getting to see a lot more communities being very careful about planning for pedestrian and bicycle transportation and safety. And bringing that all together under one planning element has been a challenge, but we believe we have succeeded.
I guess maybe in that respect, it's also they've seen the problems that that urban planners have to do to try to create bike trails and paths and the like, and how dangerous sometimes those could be. Well, they don't want them to be dangerous. They want people to be on bikes as much as possible, but that means they still have to plan this out properly to try and get around all the major routes if they want to carry them through, I would imagine. Yeah.
Oh, certainly. And that has always been a challenge, especially the way we have been planning our communities these days. I mean, ever since the 1950s when cars took over, everything's been auto-centric. You've been to South Lake Mall. Try to think about walking or biking around South Lake Mall. It just doesn't compute, and you want to live. And many of our communities are built that way. And so, unfortunately, we've had to retrofit many of these components for bicycle and pedestrian safety. But now we're seeing a lot more new developments coming in that are incorporating those into their design plans, as well as, you know, conservation and open space allocations as well. So the tide is turning.
We have what's being called the Greenways and Blueways 2020 plan. Give us an idea of all the stakeholders that are going to be involved and are involved in this. It's in the draft stage right now, but all these groups that have been involved in getting the plan to this point and still looking for more public comment, too.
Yes, we are. We're keeping public comment open until March 2nd, and it depends on what kind of comment we get in, and we might actually extend it based on that. The stakeholders are as broad as you can imagine. We identify eight major stakeholder groups, from private property owners to corporate property owners to institutions of education, of course, governmental agencies. All of these people play a critical role in making sure that we can expand our conservation and our non-motorized networks and to really build them into the very fabric of decision-making.
Once the draft gets together from all the stakeholders and everything that you've gathered, including the public and all, what's the next step for it to go on before it becomes a finalized plan?
Yes, we are, again, looking to close out public comment. We've had a 30-day comment period, and March 2nd. After that, we have committees that will review and recommend. We have two at NERPC, the Ped, Pedal, and Paddle Committee, which is our non-motorized. Mm-hmm. The Environmental Management Policy Committee, of course, deals with conservation and environmental issues. And then if they are in agreement, it moves up to the Technical Planning Committee, and they would recommend it to the full commission, hopefully for a March approval.
Now, with a project as ambitious as this, it's going to be time, I'm sure, to be able to implement the plan. Do you have to bring in the folks from outside the region, like NDOT, and maybe the Department of Natural Resources to look at this and sign off on any of this, especially if they're looking for funds to be able to do new trails or new projects?
That's a great question. And we have certainly sat down with these major stakeholders, obviously.
Right.
And we work very closely with the National Lakeshore as well, so the National Park Service. They are not mandated to approve this document. It really is a region-born and a region-approved planning process. We do have other plans where the Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Transit Administration do have to sign off. This is not one of those type of documents. So with that said, though, we are incorporating best practices that the FHWA, that the National Park Service, that DNR, NDOT, that they abide by, that they respect. And so we're making sure that we do stay in line with those agencies.
I guess it's mainly just important that if you want to do projects and you want to get supporting funding, then you have to be sure that they're pretty copacetic to whatever the agencies outside of the area probably will want. Or otherwise they say, well, we can't get you into funding in this because this doesn't fit in with the original plans or whatever the case may be, I would think.
No, it's exactly right. Okay. That's why you must make sure you respect their processes.
Okay. As this draft is underway, are there any projects or things that are in the maybe in the planning stages that would take advantage of this new plan? Are they in the works right now as far as NERPS is concerned?
And that's a great question, because what we're trying to do is shake out projects that would really work at an integrated level. A couple of them I can bring out here. A couple of visions that we do identify in the plan include the Little Calumet River Corridor, all the way from the state line, Illinois, all the way to LaPorte County, where the headwaters are at Red Mill County Park. There are a lot of great areas, open space conservation areas. We also have water trail opportunities. We have a trail as well, an off-road trail that goes through Lake County. And then there's even an opportunity to build a land bridge, a bicycle and pedestrian landscape bridge over I-94 in the Chesterton vicinity, linking the dunes to the southern part of Porter County. Mm-hmm. Again, bringing in all of these elements into one project.
That would also be interesting, I would think, here, because we know that there are opportunities to be able to let those who are involved in either biking or hiking or just recreational walking, for that matter, too, to be able to get from the lakeshore to any place over on the other side of the highway. But that big highway seems to get in the way.
And it is. I mean, if you talk to people in really all the tourism bureaus, you can talk to Lake County, you can talk to Porter and all sorts. They've all tried to get people off of the Borman, 8094, and get them to the beach or get them to other destinations in the region. And what we're trying to attempt here is actually bring the park to the roadway.
Yeah.
And so kind of draw people off the road, provide some landmark attractions, and get them to really understand that there's a lot more here than just a roadway and billboards.
Now, we talked about the fact that this is a draft right now for the Greenways and Blueways 2020 plan, and we have the public comment period underway now for a few more weeks. Once all this comes together and you get the comments in from everybody involved in this, and you start sorting things out better, when do you hope to be able to implement the plan?
Well, the plan is going to be immediately implementable right away. I mean, what we do in the implementation section, we take these eight major stakeholders, Chris, and we stretch them across all the goals and objectives that we outline. And many times when the public reads a plan, they get messed up. It's complex. There's a lot going on, a lot of ideas, and you just basically walk away going, I don't know how to make this work. And we try to break these down into kind of bite-sized components where a particular person, whoever they may be, they could be a private property owner, they could be a land trust, they can take a look and say, this is what I can do to make this happen. And we also have a call for projects at NERPC coming up later this year, where we're going to put a whole bunch of federal money on the table, and this plan is going to be matched up to those projects that come forward.
Well, sounds like a lot more work yet to be done, but there is going to be an end to this, and something will come together, and then the plan will be there that you'll actually be able to implement pretty soon, I would hope.
Yes, definitely.
Mitch Barloga, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this.
Thank you, Chris.
U.S. Department of Commerce estimates that around a quarter of STEM jobs are filled by women. So an event that was held in South Central Indiana over the weekend aimed at giving Girl Scouts a chance to hone their inner engineer. Indiana Public Broadcasting, Jeannie Lindsay was there.
There's a shortage of workers in STEM careers, or science, technology, engineering, and math. The problem is most pronounced among girls. An event on Ivy Tech's Bloomington campus this weekend aimed to get girls excited about STEM. Cook Medical Sustaining Engineer Asha Kirchhoff helped plan the activities and talks centered around engineering. One of the big goals, she says, is to connect girls with people already in the field.
So these girls can see women who have become engineers and realize it's possible for them to do the same thing.
The scouts also had a chance to do some engineering of their own and make structures to withstand a pretend earthquake. Some stick and straw creations didn't survive the table tremor, but that fit with another theme of the day: everybody fails before they succeed. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Lake County's Republican and Democratic Party primary elections are coming up on Tuesday, May 8th. Let's find out how things are coming along in preparation for the elections coming up. Michelle Fehman is the director of the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office in Crown Point. Michelle, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking. And if you will, fill us in on how things are coming along in preparation for the big primary election day coming up.
Okay, so the deadline has already passed for candidates to file for office and or withdraw. We held our lottery this past Tuesday, actually. We are the only county in the entire state that has a lottery drawing for the ballot placement on the ballot. And so we did complete that. Now that what's next is this coming Tuesday on the 27th, we will hear challenges to candidacy. So that's where an individual citizen or another candidate is challenging a candidate based on the qualifications to hold office. And so we have approximately 28 of those. Majority of them are for precinct committeemen. Some are for delegates, and then there are a few for the major offices. So once that deadline passes and we find out does all the individuals, will they remain on the ballot or will they be removed, and then we'll start the ballot preparation for the upcoming election.
I was going to ask you, when it comes to this case, since a lot of these challenges are for the, I guess what some could call lesser offices, but they're for the more localized ones as for various parties on the ballot. You talk about the precinct committee people and the like there too. Are there any real reasons why some of these people are being challenged for those particular seats?
In some of the cases for the precinct committeemen, it's based on party affiliation or voting history.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a few challenges for people that may not have resided in the precinct at the time of filing for office. They were doing the transfer or they just didn't live there. So those are a couple of the reasons for the challenges when it comes to committeemen and delegate. There are a few for major offices where they're one either indicating that someone filled out the form incorrectly or that they haven't filled out some campaign finance information.
Yeah. So there are reasons that at least have to be reviewed, I'm sure.
Exactly. And yes. So that's why the challenge process takes place. They'll come before the election board, which is made up of five members. They will hear both the person challenging and the challenger and the challenged candidate will both have an opportunity to speak and state why they should either be removed from the ballot or why they should remain on the ballot. The board will make a decision, hopefully on that day, and then we'll move forward again, like I said, with the ballot preparation, so that we'll be ready for early voting,
mm-hmm.
which at our Tuesday meeting, the board did approve. We will have our 11 early voting sites that we've had in the past. All 11 will be in place for the 2018 primary election, and voting in those locations start on April 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, that's wrong. That's the first Thursday we start. We will start voting on April 10th.
Oh, okay.
Which is a Tuesday.
Yeah. So is it becoming more and more popular now for people to take advantage of the early voting opportunities? Like you mentioned, they can start in here on April 10th?
Yes. It's been growing year after year after
yeah.
year. People like the convenience of, one, being able to go to any of the facilities, any 11 facilities. It doesn't matter where you live. If you're driving down Indianapolis Boulevard and you drive past the St. John Township Assessor's Office, stop in there and vote. If you're over in Gary, you can stop at the Genesis Center and so forth. Also, the other thing that's very convenient for the voters is on Thursday nights, we're open till 7 p.m. So that's very convenient for any of our voters who maybe work out of the area, possibly up in Chicago, and don't get home till after 6 p.m. It gives them the opportunity to go and cast a vote on the actual voting machine. And people prefer that sometimes over the ballot card. Mm-hmm. So it's been a great feature for us. We're very proud of it. We are one of the only counties that have this many. I think we are the only county that has this many early voting sites.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, when you look at Marion County, which is the largest county in the entire state, I believe they only have one.
Oh, my goodness.
So with us being the second largest and having 11, it speaks real volumes to our board, our bipartisan board, who strives to make voting accessible yeah. to the voters of the county.
Do you think also, too, that this is an opportunity that that other counties take a look at this, even Marion County, take a look at this and see how well having so many early voting sites opened up, how successful it is to be able to do this, and it kind of gives them a way to lobby to be able to create more sites?
You would think so, but we've been doing this for a number of years, and they still haven't changed their ways.
Nope.
So as well as it works for us, each county has different reasons for why they do things, whether... You know, I don't want to sit there and say anyone wants to suppress the vote ever, but in our opinion, it's better to give voters the opportunity. Also, the great thing for Lake County is we also have two dates for Saturday voting, which is also very convenient for voters who may work all day, you know, during the week, that on Saturday when they're running the errands, that they can also go and vote either on Saturday, April 28th, or May 5th, that we have voting on those days also. So that is also a nice convenience factor for all the voters.
Well, you would think that, I guess, with all the precincts that Lake County has, that in turn will all, of course, be open on Election Day on May 8th. It's still a lot of people don't want to stand in line for minutes and hours sometimes to be able to get to a voting machine to be able to vote, and they have this opportunity to do so early, and I'm sure that's why people take advantage of it.
Correct, and also people can vote by mail. So
that's right.
We've already started accepting applications, so if you're out there, you do have to meet some qualifications, but there are many qualifications on there. Some of them go as far as, you know, one, that you might be over the age of 65, you may have disabilities, you might be out of the county on election day, and a great one on there now is that you may not have transportation, and so many of us are in homes that maybe only have one or two vehicle for maybe four or five drivers, and on any given day, you may not have that vehicle. And so that is also one of the reasons for voting absentee. We, like I said, we are accepting applications already, so people can submit those. We will begin mailing ballots as early as, I believe it's March 24th. So if anyone submits an application now, you know, that'll be in the mail, again, as early as March 24th, giving them the opportunity to cast a vote there. We also have where we go out to people's homes for people that are confined or caring for a confined voter, and that's called Travel Board. And that's where we send a bipartisan team, a Democrat and Republican, to the voter's home or where their facility is that they're confined. So we go to lots of nursing homes in Lake County, and we vote them. We take an actual voting machine with us, too, and the voter will get to cast a vote right on the actual voting machine. So that's a nice feature that we also provide for our voters.
We're talking with Michelle Fehman, who is the director of the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office in Crown Point. And it's going to go back here to the ballot for the Republican and the Democratic parties in 2018 for the primary elections here. Michelle, if you will, give us an idea of some of the major races that folks will get to see on the ballot when they either do their absentee voting or they go to early voting or actually show up on Election Day.
So we have a couple federal offices on the ballot. So we have United States Senator and United States Representative. We have some state races that are on the ballot, so we have state senator running in certain portions of the county. All of our state representatives are running. We also have, on the local level, we have our prosecutor, our clerk, county auditor, county treasurer, county sheriff, which is a hot topic right now, county assessor. We have one county commissioner on the ballot. We have all of our county council. And then we have a lot of, every township is running this year. So we have township assessors, trustees, and board members. We also have a few various towns that are up this year where they stagger their terms. And so for the town offices, we have Cedar Lake, Dyer, Lowell, Schererville, and St. John.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have precinct committeemen and delegates to the state convention. So on the Democrat side, we have precinct committeemen. The Republicans stagger their term, and so they, for committeemen, won't run until 2020. So if you're asking for a Democrat ballot, you may see Democrat precinct committeemen on there.
I see. One of the other things, too, I know that, and this comes up only when it's asked to be on the ballot, is they have several school districts that are looking to ask their voters for asking some referendum questions. And we know that there are two, at least two, that are on the ballot here in the primary election, aren't they?
Those two being Crown Point and Lake Central School Corporation will be asking for a referendum on the ballot, which has been approved and everything looks to be in place for that. So if you live in those two communities, you will also see a question on the ballot.
And we're also going to find out here this week more about what the Crown Point Community School Corporation is asking voters to accept. And we'll find out more from the Lake Central School Corporation officials about that in the days ahead before the election. This is one of these interesting questions that come up that people realize that, you know, they typically happen on primary days, although we do know that that's not always the case, that referendum questions can be asked on the November ballot as well, can't they?
Yes, they can. For people that want to know exactly what the question is, because unfortunately sometimes they make the questions a little bit confusing, so it's always good to know in advance before Election Day who is on your ballot and what questions are going to be on the ballot. So as a way to help facilitate that, we do put an entire list of the candidates and the public questions on our website, which is going to be www.lakecountyin.org. You'll go to the election page on there, and there'll be a list of all the candidates and offices on there. Now, another great place you can go is you can go to indianavoters.com, And that is a great website because not only can you register to vote on that site, as long as you have a driver's license, you can register to vote on that site. You can also hit the button that says, where's my polling place? You can hit the button that says, who's on my ballot? And it'll tell you every candidate. You'll select your county, and if you went Democrat or Republican, it's going to tell you every candidate that's going to be on there. With the exception of committeemen and delegate, they don't show up on there just because we have so many of them.
Right.
But you can see a number of different things on that website. So I encourage voters to, one, double check, make sure you are a registered voter. If you are not, you have until April 9th to register to vote. And that is going to be on a Monday. April 9th at 11:59 is the deadline for registering to vote.
So get out there, and if you haven't registered to vote, do so now. Get your opportunity in there so that that you're able to be able to cast your ballot, whichever way that you choose to do it, on primary election day. And I do know that the Indiana Voters website has been revised and made much better. So it'd be something to look forward to if you want to find out more information. So we're talking with Michelle Fehman. She's director of the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office in Crown Point. And as always, Michelle, thank you very much. We'll be checking back in as we get close to the deadlines and see how things are shaping up. And we appreciate you spending some time with us today.
For those that are registering to vote, keep in mind you can be 17 years of age and still vote in the primary election. You must be 18 on or before the November election, which is going to be November 6th. So for anyone who is, you know, 17 years old and you're thinking you can't vote, again, as long as you're 18 by November 6th, you can register and vote in this year's primary.
That's a good point to remember. Thank you for reminding us about that. Michelle, thank you. We'll be back checking with you again later.
No problem. You have a great day.
You too. Genomic sequencing maps your DNA, and doctors and scientists can use this information to find the best treatment for a specific person. People are excited because some of these treatments are not as invasive. In fact, one may already be in your medicine cabinet. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that Hoosier scientists are reporting some encouraging success with this precision medicine.
Cancer, at its essence, is a disease of DNA. Cancer is caused when there's certain typos in that blueprint.
Dr. Milan Radovich is a genomic scientist in Indianapolis. Those typos are mutations
that transform a single normal cell to go haywire and become cancerous.
Radovich is co-director of the Precision Genomics Group at Indiana University Health. The group recently opened a new clinic in Indianapolis where they can sequence a person's entire genome in a few days. It used to take a lot longer.
We had hundreds of machines sequencing a single human genome, and that took 11 years. So nowadays, it takes one box that you can fit on top of a table, and it takes a couple days.
Unlocking the genomic map allows scientists to advance treatments in many conditions, but most of the work has been done with cancer treatment. Brian Schneider is the other director of the IU Health Precision Genomics Group.
If you'll take the mechanic analogy, it's like popping up the hood on the car. By understanding the genomics, you can really start to see at intricate levels what makes it different.
What makes each cancer so different? Schneider says a look at the genetic level reveals surprises.
There are actually some forms of breast cancer at the genomic level that look like ovarian cancer more than it does other forms of breast cancer.
And this is redefining some approaches to cancer treatment.
As we begin to think about the cancer more in terms of what drives it as opposed to what body part did it happen to start in.
That's where personalized medicine comes in. Each person's therapy tailored to their specific genetic mutation. But one cancer genome could have over 100,000 mutations, and finding matches can be tricky.
It's playing the adult version of Go Fish, right? You're trying to find what typographical errors activate what pathways that might match best with a drug developed to inhibit it.
And sometimes you get lucky. Gwen Brack was a 21-year-old junior in college when she was diagnosed with stage 4 rectal cancer.
Things started moving really fast.
First, the chemotherapy.
I then proceeded to have proton radiation therapy. And then I had my first major surgery the following fall.
Then more rounds of chemotherapy drugs and 9 abdominal surgeries over 9 years.
And then a year ago, we found a tumor on my bladder.
That was when she was referred to the Precision Genomics Program in Indianapolis. When they sequenced her genome, they found a particular mutation, a mutation that was the focus of some recent research.
I remember Dr. Schneider emailed me the New England Journal of Medicine article like the day before I came in for my appointment and said, you know, nerd out on this because we've got good news coming for you.
Turns out aspirin can block some cancer-causing genes.
That aspirin could be the miracle drug in my case. You can imagine my relief.
Today, Brack is celebrating 1 year of being cancer-free. In total, Indiana University Health operates 4 clinics across the state that provide access to precision medicine. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Julia Cook-Jones is a new member of almost a 3-month-old baby, and she is one of many success stories in the Nurse Family Partnership, which is set up by Goodwill and Central and Southern Indiana. With us, we have not only Julia Cook-Jones with us, but we have Paulette Maxey. She's the Director of Operations for the Nurse Family Partnership. Ladies, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us.
First off, Paulette, if you will, please explain what the Nurse Family Partnership is.
Sure. Nurse Family Partnership is a national program that is nurse-led. Here in Indiana, it's implemented by Goodwill Industries in conjunction with both Central and Southern Indiana, as well as Michiana Goodwill. And we provide a free personal nurse for pregnant moms throughout their pregnancy and until the child is 2 years old. The program provides a nurse who helps that mom with everything from what pregnancy is going to be like, how to have a good, healthy, nutritious diet, how to have a healthy baby, how to find an apartment if they're looking for housing, or how to find resources that they may need for transportation or for school. The focus is mainly to have a healthy pregnancy, a healthy baby, but to also help that mom become economically self-sufficient and to be able to have the best life that she can for her and her baby.
Now, how critical is it to have a program like this available for mothers here in Northwest Indiana?
It's extremely critical because we're in an area with multiple health disparities, including the high rate of preterm birth and one of the highest rates of infant death before the age of 1 year old in the country. So there's other home visiting agencies, but ours is the only one that is specifically all nurses and also focuses on intensity of visits and making sure that we are training and helping that mom in multifaceted. It's important to, we don't take the place of any medical care. You know, we encourage the moms to keep their prenatal visits. As a matter of fact, most of our moms have a higher rate of keeping prenatal visits with their physicians. They also are better at making sure that they keep their babies at their visits, to their well baby visits after they deliver. So it's very critical in the health of the mom and the baby and the community.
Would you say those are probably the best benefits to note of the program?
You know what? There are many other benefits. This program has been shown, it's throughout the country, so it's in 43 other states, and it's been shown statistically since the 1970s when it implemented to transform the lives of vulnerable moms and babies and their families. And there are things that are a benefit to society, including things like a 46% reduction in infant mortality, a decrease of smoking during pregnancy by about 25%, and then, of course, all the illnesses that relate to that, a decrease in language delay for the children by about 40%, 33% less ER visits for childhood injuries, and a decrease in pregnancy-induced hypertension by about 32%, which is one of the leading causes of maternal mortality. So these are things that are costly and they impact the families greatly.
Now, Julia Cook-Jones, let's turn to you now, please. Tell us first a little bit about yourself.
Yes, hello. I am a Purdue Northwest student studying communication and public relations. I am currently a senior. I have my son November 6, 2017, and he is about to be 3 months on the 6th.
Wow, that's great. That's great. How did you become a client of the Nurse Family Partnership?
Well, I actually went to one of their events they were sponsoring, and I went over to the table. I want to know a little bit more about it, and I was hooked from then.
I know that you have some great people that are making up your support system to help get you through not only taking care of your newborn, but also getting yourself through school, too, because I understand you went back to your studies at Purdue Northwest after you had your baby.
Yes.
There are probably a number of people that are close and help out, and maybe just friends that help out too, but who are the people that you count on the most?
My nurse Karen and the staff at NSP. If it wasn't for them, I really don't know how I would have transitioned into being the parent I am today, and my family. Without the help of NSP, my family wouldn't have this transition because my son is the last grandson, really. So they needed to prepare more don't have the baby sleeping in the bed with pillows. Don't feed them often. It's so much with parenting that old parents do not know about. So the babies are transformed, and so is parenthood. So they really helped me and guide me through that transition.
Now, going through what you've experienced with the Nurse Family Partnership, what would you say are the most benefits that you have seen from it?
The greatest benefit is knowing that I have someone other than my family and my friends to be that number one support system. So it's been times where I have to cry and I cannot cry or vent to anyone, not even my friends, my family. But I know that my nurse Karen will always be there for me and my son.
Now, what are your plans when you graduate from Purdue University Northwest? Have you made any yet?
Yes. When I graduate, I would like to pursue my master's, hopefully in a nonprofit relating field. And therefore, I can go into, hopefully, Nurse Family Partnership if I can grant the greatness that they have gave me and my son to other mothers and families that are in need.
Now, let's turn back to you, Paulette. What are the qualifications that people might have to face to be able to be participants in this special program?
Sure. The mom has to be pregnant and enrolled in the program before the end of her 28th week of pregnancy. She has to have no prior live birth. She must live in, currently, our branch is only in Lake County. Mm-hmm. There are plans for expansion, but right now we only cover Lake County. And then she also has to be eligible for programs like WIC, Medicaid, TANF. They don't have to necessarily be in those programs, but just have the same income, meet the same income criteria. And, they can self-refer by contacting our office, which is 219-444-2000. Or they can be referred by their doctor, by the WIC program, by their case manager. We're making sure our information is at the township offices. Any place that they can go and get assistance, they will be able to get information about our program. And Chris, who wouldn't love to have their own free personal nurse during pregnancy and early childhood? As Julia mentioned, sometimes there are questions that you want to ask or things that you need to know that you don't want to feel judged. And so you don't go to your family, but you can go to your own personal nurse. And that person helps you work through problems, through sick baby days, through finding resources for jobs, through finding housing, getting out of a violent situation and helping you find shelter. So just all kinds of things. It's not just a nursing program. Mm-hmm. It's also a holistic program.
Well, we've been talking with Paulette Maxey, who is the Director of Operations for the Nurse Family Partnership, which is a big program that's involved with the Goodwill Industries Central in Southern Indiana and the Goodwill Industries of Michiana, which, of course, we are a part of, as well as having with us to talk about the services and how it's personally helped her, a new mom, Julia Cook-Jones. Ladies, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate the information, and we hope that this program does grow and branches out to other counties here in Northwest Indiana soon.
Thank you so much.
With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, back with us to talk about the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra's third and final classic concert of the 2017-18 season. Kirk, this is a concert that's coming up at Bethel Church Auditorium in Crown Point on March the 16th. Can you please tell us about it?
Well, I'd be happy to, John. First of all, I have one of the members of the Chicago Symphony coming to play the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. It was written just a few months before the end of Mozart's death, and still, to this day, it is the most famous and important clarinet concerto in the world. What's interesting about it for me is that at the time, the clarinet was not really an instrument that people played, and so for Mozart to write this amazing and beautiful and touching piece on this instrument is rather amazing to me just before he died, just a few weeks before he died, it was premiered. And my J. Laurie Bloom, who was one of the clarinetists from the Chicago Symphony, is coming to play that piece for us. So we have some Mozart, and people are always asking me for Mozart. On the other end of the spectrum, John, mm-hmm. we have Tchaikovsky, and we're doing from two of the great ballets, of course, Sleeping Beauty and Swan Lake. We're doing the two suites from this. And, you know, what's really interesting to me, John, is that the Chicago Symphony this year is doing both of those suites at some point with Riccardo Muti. So we must be doing something right, you know, with our programming.
It's beautiful music.
Oh, my gosh. It is gorgeous.
It's the best. I love those suites. But you also have programmed something quite unusual, something called a tango mass. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes, thank you, John. Yeah, this is by Bakalov, Luis Bakalov, who is the Argentinian composer who writes so much film music. You know, if you know that great and heartbreaking film Il Postino, it's that kind of music. And because he's Argentinian, he wrote a mass. So it has a Sanctus and a Kyrie and all that. But mm-hmm. they're all written in the style of a tango. Mm-hmm. So we have two soloists and the chorus, and we have a bandoneon player, which is like the Argentinian accordion playing. Mm-hmm. And it's very exotic and beautiful and sensual, and yet it's still a mass. Mm-hmm. You know, it still is using the text of a mass. It's very unusual, and you know, the chorus gets to sing with us and be there with our two soloists. So hopefully it's a diverse, interesting, and, you know, we don't want our audience to be bored. That's for darn sure.
Now, I managed to acquire a ticket. I went with one of my cousins to a concert 20 years ago, one Friday night at Orchestra Hall in Chicago, and Daniel Barenboim was playing the piano. And there was a bass, I believe it was a trio, and it was a bass player, and how do you say the accordion instrument, bandoneon?
Bandoneon.
I have to see it written out so to know how to say it right. But anyway, it was an evening of tangos, Argentine tangos, and it was so beautiful. They had CDs available, and I bought one in the lobby at intermission. And I played it to death. I mean, the poor little jewel case of the CD is just cracked, and it's barely hanging on. But, oh, that boy.
It makes sense, actually, with Barenboim, because he was born in Argentina, mm-hmm. and he has that enormous affinity for all of that music. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and it is, again, very sensual, and, you know, it's tango. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it was beautiful. And yeah, so audiences will really enjoy that, I think, especially. Well, great. So that's on Friday, March the 16th. That's our final classical concert of the season. Then we have our Pops concert in the spring in May, which will be performed in two locations, at Bethel Church once again, and then also at Highland High School's Monbeck Auditorium. And those dates are the Friday and Saturday of Mother's Day weekend.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I say these things tentatively, even though they're all set. Everything's set. But originally, of course, that was going to be at the Star Plaza Theater, which is no more. So, all right, Kirk. Well, thank you for being here to tell us about the concerts. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.